So with this series of coming to an end, and as we have talked about preparing for marriage, preparing for heaven, that has been my goal all throughout, that we really see this as a preparation time, that we've come here, that God has given us opportunity to hear the gospel, to obey it, and to be a part of His great family. And as we have had this blessing and had the opportunity to be in His family, we have wanted to then recognize, as we have used these verses, Genesis 2, 18 through 24, all week long. And as we have used this theme, we recognize that God has given us the home. To begin with, and as we have repeatedly returned to the fact that as there was the six-day creation, and as great as that creation was, we think with thanksgiving and admiration that on the sixth day that God gave us the home. The home was a part of the creation. But what we know is that the home was indeed a creation, just as we speak of each of the days of creation and coming then to the last day and the creation of the animal life and, of course, mankind. But as that, we then had the beginning of the home, and we have followed that theme all the way through. And so as we have followed that theme all the way through, we have tried to emphasize the fact that this is something very special because it is God's creation. And we have to think of it in those terms. Tonight, we'll just use it in kind of the where we began, that there's God's home and ours, and coming, as it were, full circle. So it was that in the beginning, that and on the sixth day of creation, that God created a unique form of life, namely man. And God said, it is not good that man should be alone. And thus we found that He then created a helper that was suitable for him, or as the New King James says, comparable to him. And as He created the woman to complement man, that each would be suitable for the needs of the other, that each walking together hand in hand. We've emphasized the thought, or sometimes it is emphasized that it is taking the rib from the side and not from the foot, that he should trample her under, or from the head, that either would be overly dominant, just dominating character over the other, but the indeed from the side, that they could walk down life side by side together. And so what we find is that God brought her to man, as we see then in the 2:22. And the bringing about the marriage of these two, then which, and as all other living things, they were able to pass themselves along, as it were, into the next generation. And we have found that some characteristics of the human bond. What you're going to find in today's lesson is kind of a summarization of what we have done this Sunday through Thursday. But I want to bring it up and make it clear in our minds what it is that we are working toward, what we've been trying to do this week, and what we're not just this week or this night, but what is going to happen then further on, as we all would have that goal of after what. Certainly, as we see the characteristic of the human bond is created by God, was the couple was to continue then until one of them dies. We saw that in Romans chapter 7 and verse 2. And again, it is that same idea in 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 39, that there was to be a continuance, that this is a bond that was made, and it begins with that. It begins with a bond, it begins with the pledge of that bond, that it is going to be a lifetime commitment. And so many, of course, do not look at it that way now. As we mentioned, two examples of the little boy on the school bus who said he knew who he was going to, when he grew up, he knew that who it would be that he would marry and divorce. That he had seen so much of that, he thought that was the natural form of things, that it would just be the natural part of life. And sometimes, even in God's order, that might happen, but that is not the goal. The goal is the permanence. And of course, as we saw too, that it was to be a one man, one woman relationship. And we see in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 2 that each man have his own wife and each woman have her own husband. As God created then for Adam what he needed, he created then a companion. He created the one companion that as when he created Eve, he had then the that which satisfied what that which God had given. Now keep in mind that God himself had created man, and it wasn't that he had shortchanged him. It just simply was a part of the development of humankind. As he created Adam or man, thus then he created a woman, Eve, and each then, as we have suggested, complemented each other. While in that relationship, of course, fidelity toward each other is to be faithfully maintained. And again, we see such violation of that today. And we can see the many, many violations of this. As we have turned to Ephesians 5, and I would just simply refer to that now, that we see there that it is given an interesting illustration. The husband-wife relationship is used there to make to be an illustration with regard to the church. And Paul makes that clear at the end of Ephesians in chapter 5. He makes it clear that that's what he is talking about when he said, "This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church." But in using this, when he said the husbands should love their wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it. And then that, and it goes on then to mention a number of things that he has sought to accomplish. That he did accomplish in his giving of himself. And as we see that he would sanctify, cleanse her, that is the church, washing the water by the word. He might present her to himself as being a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing. But that she should be holy and without blemish. So husbands ought to love their own wives. And it is in that same manner then is such a dedication. Was Christ ever unfaithful to the church? Obviously not. And we then, and thinking of this model that is here, that we'd recognize then that we, as husbands, would not be unfaithful to our bride, the church, and the wife, as he was faithful to the church. So we would be then faithful to the wife. In like manner, so it was then the husband was to be faithful. In everything and in every way, and as we have emphasized in other lessons, the spiritual aspect of the church, so that we see the spiritual aspect in our lives as we are part of that spiritual family of God and as we are part of his body, that is, the church. And then as we continued, we suggested that there are elemental points made in Genesis 1 and 2, and other characteristics are just as fundamental. As we carry on with this, we see that the husband and wife are to help each other go to heaven. 1 Corinthians 7:16. How do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband, or O husband, whether you will save your wife? It is a goal that this kind of thing be done. Now, it's interesting in the setting, if you read the context here of chapter 7, that this was an interesting time. It was the beginning of the church, the beginning of the gospel, and many had not heard it. And some adults, some married people had heard the word and then obeyed it, and then not to have the spouse obey the word. That gave them a problem, it seemed. And so they had to work on that. And one of the goal was to be, of course, both of them obeying the gospel. We'll not get into all the particulars of the rest of that, but that was the goal. The goal was for them to both be then and in Christ, and that they help each other go to heaven. Further, we can see that as parents, that these are to teach their children various responsibilities, and certainly the responsibilities in being obedient to parents. As we see in Ephesians 6:1, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. We can see that this is something that is to be done, and parents have a responsibility there. In verse 4, that we read there with regard to fathers to bring their children up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. They had that responsibility. And so it is that we want to remember this spiritual aspect. Now, is there a physical aspect of the word? Obviously. The same 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter that we've referred to so many times, as in verse 16. What in the first 5 verses shows that there is a physical aspect of marriage and that it is to be honored. But we want to keep the goal out in front of us, that the end, the ultimate end, of course, is heaven. That the salvation is there. And so we teach our children then that they are to be obedient to parents and that they are to be obedient to God. You remember the time that that the rest of the apostles, and we read from Acts, for instance, Acts 5:20, and they were saying, you know, whether you folks think that we ought to obey you rather than God, you be the judge. But we will follow God. And we're going to follow God rather than men. They made that pledge, much like we think of Joshua. As for me and my house, we will serve God. We will serve the Lord. So we teach the children to be obedient to parents, to be obedient to God, and ultimately then goal too is to be saved. We need to start early with all of these things and teaching our children. And I've admired the fact that we've had some little ones among us every night of the meeting, all the way through Sunday morning and Sunday night and every night through the meeting. This is something that is being instilled in them at a very early age, that this is important. This is something that they are going to learn, and as they, as indeed they do learn by this experience. The first learning experience of obedience, of course, is in the home, as learning to obey parents. And then as this transference or as this continuance of obedience then is extended to God. As we think of such passages, of course, of the very famous and well-known John 3:16, God did so love the world that he gave his only begotten son. Why? That it was the thought that as if he could give his son as this sufficient sacrifice, that whoever would believe in him could be saved. It is a desire to God that all would be. Not all will be, because not all will accept. But it certainly it was his desire, and strong enough, and he loved us enough that he would give his only begotten son to be saved. And as we think of the apostle saying in 2 Timothy 4:8, that there was then a crown of righteousness to be won, not only for him but for all. It can be done. It needs to be a goal of every family that this would be done. Husband, wife, children, that there would be a salvation. This is the home that God created. We talked in the first lesson, and we've mentioned it from time to time, that we can think of the home as a divine human institution. Divine in the fact that God designed it. God gave it to us. He gave it for us. We're to benefit by it. And then it is human in that we are involved in it. And so all of those things are a part of it. Now then, in the light of all this, we realize that parents need to teach their children further the value of marrying Christians. Now this I've mentioned from the very first, and this is something that I want to emphasize again. And this is, I've had people virtually fight me on this, but I'm going to tell you I'm a firm believer in it, and I want to advocate that this is what is being, what should be done. Give your children a chance. Give them a chance and to help them to understand the value in this. You think back on God and teaching his children under the old law and the kind of thing that they were to do, to marry within their ranks. We can see various examples of those who step out of that. We'll expand on that a little bit later. But the value of marrying Christians should be a part of that which is given by parents for their children. And of course, the importance of bringing up their children in the discipline and admonition of the Lord. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Can fathers provoke their children? Obviously they can. And sometimes the children are provoked without provocation. They just take that as part of the growing process, perhaps. But that's a part of our training, that if we have the patience for them, the love for them, and the love of God in our hearts, as well as the love of child, we can properly train them. Now, as we talked about the background, in Genesis 6, just 10 generations after creation, we learn that God was sorry that he had made man. And I've thought about that a good many times. It's hard for me to think, in one way, it's hard for me to think of God as being unhappy. On the other hand, when he sees the mass disobedience, the mass rejection, certainly we would tend to think that God could be unhappy, certainly about all of that. And this is what happened then, as when there were people who did not do as God wanted them to do. And so what happened? Well, as we see that the record informs us in Genesis chapter 6 and verse 2, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and that they took wives for themselves, all of all whom they chose. Now, I don't want to say something that this passage doesn't say. And yet I noticed something here that's rather interesting. And it's worth at least dwelling on for a little bit for thought. The sons of God, daughters of men. There seems to be a contrast. Now, this doesn't mean that all men are righteous and all women are unrighteous. But in this particular case, what it is saying here is with regard to the choices that were made. Remember last evening, as we talked about the idea that when seeking a wife, that you realize that if you you seek one, that she is either going to be a child of God, or, let's see, what was the other half of that? Remember what was said, and Paul said about Elymas? You son of the devil. That's the choices. And indeed, here as we think of the choices that can be made, let us make sure that we give our children the training and the leading so that they will know whom they are marrying. Perhaps we can even say what they are marrying. It's a value that needs to be considered. No matter how beautiful an individual is on the outside, if that individual does not have the beauty of holiness on the inside, there's going to be trouble. You're playing on an uneven field. You're playing with a different set of rules. You have the different standards. Going to heaven, I want to ask you something. I won't ask for a show of hands, but let me just ask you. How many of you think going to heaven's easy? If you think it's easy, you don't know what it is to go to heaven. It's a job. It's work. We have to work at it. We have to resist the devil. We have to fight him. We have to keep him out of our lives. And that's work. Sometimes that's hard. But when the temptation comes, we can win. There's no temptation comes upon us, Paul said, but what is common to man. And God will give us a way of escape. With every temptation, he will give us a way of escape. Now, we have to take it. He's not going to grab us and drag us along kicking and screaming. We have to make the choice and we have to come, but he provides the opportunity. And we need to let our children know that as well. And to bring it to their minds so that it is very clear to them. The example that I alluded to, and we'll do a little more here, after leaving Egypt, the children of Israel were warned repeatedly not to marry the people of the lands that they were going to occupy. And if they would go into those lands, there would be idolatry. There would be people that they should not give their daughters to or to take daughters for their sons. They were not to do that. And so there are several verses that we could consider in all of this. The thought is both in Exodus and then as we read from Joshua 23, they shall be snares and traps. Snares and traps. that here is something, and they, well, here's, oh, don't they make a nice looking couple? But are they alike? Are they unified in thought? Are they unified in God? One of our granddaughters was using some of that technical stuff the guys have been talking to me about this week. I can't think of the word Skype. Is that the right word? And she was using that with a friend of hers who was in Florida going to school. And she was talking to her, and one day someone else appeared in the background of that, and the granddaughter says, "Who's that?" "Well, it's a friend." And they exchanged hellos, and after a while, they exchanged then email addresses and began to talk about particular Bible verses. "What do you think this means?" Each one and asking the other, and they would discuss, and they found out, the more they studied, the more they found out that their thinking was a great deal alike. And after a while, that flourished into a rather nice friendship. And later, it came to be a marriage. But that wasn't the first step for either one of them. They were just both interested in studying the Bible. What does this verse mean? And they began to study those things. They had an interest in things spiritual. You're dating someone who is not a Christian. How interested is he or she in talking about the Word of God? How much have they thought about going to heaven or what they can or cannot or should not do in order to make that goal? And so it is the idea of being as close as you can to God. In Deuteronomy chapter 7, we know that, especially in verse 3, there that they were not to make marriages with the occupants of the lands and the foreigners and so on that had no interest in God or who are only interested in idolatry, for they will turn your sons away from following the Lord. They will turn your sons away from following the Lord. And that's sad. And it doesn't have to happen. But the intermarrying we see there would turn them away from God and to idols. We see it happen to a strong man like Solomon. That here he was led away by foreign women. They enticed him, tempted him, and he turned. And he even built the high places or places of worship for their idols. And then as we think about today, our society gives little regard to laws governing marriage and the home. And it is so sad that governments get involved. You hear the expression often, you can't legislate morality. Guess what is legal? Legislating immorality. Can't legislate morality, but you can legislate immorality. And you can then say, marriage is no longer just one man and one woman. It can be man and man, woman and woman. They can be married in some states, several states. And this by law. And people who think against that and teach against that are called a lot of names. Mean-spirited. They are discriminatory. They are intolerant on the basis of prejudice. And on it goes. And it is allowed. By legislation. And so again, I say society gives little, and even laws that govern such things as this. But you know what's worse than that? What's worse than that is that the Lord's people have been tainted by all this. And by views which originate with Satan's people. And that's too bad. It happens. It has happened. And we've had many homes among us disrupted, ruined, because of the influence of those outside the family of God. Certainly it is pastime for us to evaluate ourselves as husbands and as wives, and as we think of being parents and children. We have to evaluate ourselves on all of these bases. What do I want to be? Do I really want to go to heaven? For those who haven't been here with us all week, we've emphasized from the very beginning, from the very first lesson, the first five words of the Bible. In the beginning, God created. And if you don't believe those five words, you can't believe the rest of the Bible. There's no basis for believing the rest of it. First place, there are those who don't believe that God is. And then they don't believe that God that God created. And so that just really throws out the rest of it. And if we cannot believe that in the beginning God created, then we just don't have a good basis. We don't have really any basis for believing the rest of the Bible. John 3:16 is useless without believing those first five words. And what we want to understand here is that our people sometimes have allowed their thoughts to be diluted, allowed their religion to be diluted, allowed their faith to be weakened, diluted, if you will, because of the majority's action. Coming home from school, I might ask my mother for permission to do something. And I can't even think of a good example now, but anyway, permission to do something. And the answer was no. And I said, but everybody's doing it. Now, perhaps you young guys never used that, but I was, you know, quite creative in my day, and so that's the phrase I used. Everybody's doing it. Mother said, well, if everybody jumped off the cliff, would you? That aggravated me, so I didn't want to jump off the cliff. I just wanted to do what everybody else was doing. But you understand the idea that we can be pressured, and we are. In the workplace, at school, in our society, we do feel the influence of others. Now, how we respond to that, and we need to equip ourselves, our spouses, our children, how then to withstand peer pressure, how to be true to God. And we need to keep this in mind. The world will not be a better place until God's people live as he intended. And if we don't, if we just not going to react as God would have us act, how can we expect those around us to do any better? We have to be strong. We have to do that which is right. Some time ago, Levon and I visited the Mammoth Caves in southwestern Kentucky. And we went into a large and truly mammoth-sized room. And the man who was directing us, guiding us through, then wanted to show us something. He says, now, if you have any tendency at all to get disoriented in the dark, I suggest you step forward and hold on to there was a bar rail out in front of us. Because he said, this may do it. And he, anyway, built all of this out in the suspense, and he said, now, watch. And he threw a switch. We could hear the click, you know, as he threw the switch. The lights went out. And he was so disappointed. Because just around the corner, perhaps 100 yards from where we were, there was a workman. And on his helmet was a real small light bulb casting a light. And the utter total darkness that the man wanted us to experience wasn't there. Because that little bitty light pierced the darkness. Do you think how much darkness there was there? That was just a little bitty bulb, no larger than the nail of my little finger. And it dispelled darkness. Now, don't you see where you are? All around us is a darkness, right? Sin is around us. But if you are that light where you are will shine, it will pierce the darkness. You be that light. You can. Now, you won't chase away all the dark, but you'll chase it away where you are. And that's the challenge that we can offer ourselves, our spouses, our children. And so that certainly the beginning of the home, briefly documented, as we said in Genesis 2, the animals were able to send themselves into the next generation, and so could man. But the primary purpose of woman's creation was companionship. And so as we see then in Genesis 2:18, as God did create that person, and we've shown before that there were three basic purposes here in that companionship. One was procreation. That here, that they were to be fruitful and multiply. The connubiality. They had a right, and indeed they had an obligation toward each other, as we see in 1 Corinthians 7 and the first three verses. In the same chapter, he talks about the spiritual welfare. Paul then talks about both the physical and the spiritual aspects of the marriage. And all these are part of the companionship implied there in Genesis. Now, as we think of all these things, we saw then, and I want to emphasize, because this is my last night here, I want to emphasize to you about the home, that it is surely that divine institution designed by God, monogamous in form, one man, one woman, patriarchal in government. And we see these passages, and we've read them all this week. But the idea was, and even as we get this thought, that Christ over man over woman, and God over Christ. But as we see this, that this is not putting anybody second class, it's just simply God's order of things. We see the religious in spirit, and we saw that in the Old Testament, how they were to teach themselves, they were to teach their children and their grandchildren. And as we come into the New Testament, we can see the command and we can see the example. Provoke not your children to wrath, bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. 2 Timothy 1, we saw that with regard to Timothy's mother and grandmother. And indissoluble in nature. God did not intend for it to end except in death. That's the rule. Now, we can argue all day about various kinds of exceptions, but the rule is simply separation by death. If you want to expand on the other part of that and talk about exceptions sometime, so we can arrange that, but I want us to see that the main thing, this is it, that God intended a lifelong arrangement. And those who married with Saul, and we want to emphasize again, have three major tasks. Help each other go to heaven. As Peter called it, joint heirs of life. To train up their children in the Lord. And as we see further, to teach their children how to choose a mate and how to be a mate. It's interesting how such carelessness can be given to this, and just as though it's going to happen naturally. We need training in it. Not all, of course, have the right to marry, and as we want to see that only those not previously married. 1 Corinthians 7:39, when one spouse has died, in such passages as Romans 7:13, with one who has put away a spouse for adultery, and then a search of the scripture will not reveal any others who have the right. We can search all that we want, and there are just simply not any others. Early teaching of the children is needed to counter the teaching of society. Premarital sex, extramarital sex, same-sex unions, and multiple marriages, and all of these are within the right of the bounds of personal choice. We need to counter that. And as we have talked about this before, as I'm leaving you, I want to leave you with the emphasis that we can counter it, but it's not going to happen by accident. We have to reinforce ourselves as husbands and wives, and together we reinforce our children and lead them in the way that's right. Are God's people affected? Have they been affected? And it's a resounding yes. They have been. And we can see it. Far too many of us know far too many who are tragically, soul threateningly affected. And this is it. It can't be just a case, well, that's too bad. I'm sorry it didn't work out. Folks, we're talking about souls here. We're not just talking about a 50 or 60 years, or once in a while we hear those that reach a 70 years of marriage. It's hard to, you know, to think about that, but here are those who accomplish such goals as that. But if they were truly happy every day of their lives for 72 years and go to hell, what have they accomplished? You see, we need to think in terms of eternity, not just a paltry 72 years or whatever number we want to throw in there. What we need to understand is eternity and what that eternity means. Indeed, God's people are not just affected. All too many are actually, as we can see them, involved. And once more, let's not forget to ask these questions. Will he or she help me go to heaven? Well, is he or she worth going to hell for? That's a big question right there. And will he or she help me prepare my children to go? Is it worth going to hell for? And then have I answered these questions carefully, prayerfully, honestly? And of course, I believe there's an overriding question in all of this, and does he or she believe in and obey God's laws concerning marriage and morality? If they don't believe in this, if the prospective spouse does not believe then in God's standards, then what chance are you going to have? And thus we need to emphasize that for ourselves, to be strong for ourselves if we're seeking, and to train our children in seeking that is something too well considered. So many distractions along the way. There are indeed so many distractions that we can't even begin to name. But we have to admit that we need help. We need support. We need encouragement all along the way. One who has an unbelieving spouse will find that walk more difficult. It's just the uneven playing field. Bringing up children in the Lord is, of course, a formidable task. And this is going to be that which is made so much more difficult if one parent is not a Christian. Women are being taught they need not submit to husband or to God. There's just no need for it. And, of course, many of those, and of course, so many atheist women don't even understand what that means. And they cannot understand and cannot appreciate what it means. But if we then find one, the husband and the wife, both living by the laws of God, the wife will be honored. She will be respected, appreciated, and is certainly not second class. But there is an order of things. Many a good man has been denied the opportunity to serve as an elder because of an unbelieving spouse. Many a good woman has lost her children to the devil because of an unbelieving spouse. It hurts, but it's beyond real comprehension if we don't give consideration to eternity. Eternity is out there in front of us. All too often, parents teach or advise their children what to eat and how to eat and what clothes to wear and what courses to take in school, how to prepare for a career, and on that list might go, then say little or nothing about how or where to choose a lifelong mate. They need guidance. And they can use good, strong guidance. And they must have it if we are to be children, faithful children of God. Think about the things that you get involved in. And would you allow your children to look for a dependable car in the junkyard? or for wholesome food in a garbage can, or to say look for a wife or a husband at a bathing beach, at a singles bar, on the dance floor among the devil's children. You see, they need guidance. They need guidance. Parents, I hope that you will keep this in mind. One will either marry children of God, as thus described to us in Romans 8:16, or it will be children of the devil, as in described to us in Acts 13:10. And so the big question comes, which will you choose? Which will you choose for your children? As an adult, which would you choose for yourself? God gave us marriage and the home. And he gave it to us for the continuity of the human race and for its happiness here on earth. And living by God's laws and following the principles of marriage, one can have all the happiness and contentment of marriage, and heaven too. This is important, that we realize that heaven is there for the reaching. God has made it possible for us, and he gave his son indeed to make that possible. John 14:2, and Jesus said, "In my Father's house are many mansions. I go to prepare a place for you." In Philippians 3, our citizenship is in heaven. And we need to think about in those terms, that our citizenship is in heaven. He has promised us, as we see in 1 Peter 1:4, that there can be an inheritance incorruptible, undefiled, and that does not fade away. We read in such passages as Revelation 21, there'll be no tears, no crying, no sorrow, no pain. It's a wonderful thought of all that is made available to us. And as we think of Paul in writing to Timothy, and the record is in 2 Timothy chapter 4, and if we begin reading there in verse 8, finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give me in that day. And not to me only, but also all who have loved his appearing.